Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Stephen. And having been on the National Security Council yourself, what did you think of the farewell broadside by General McMaster, who's been fired to be replaced by John Bolton on April the 9th? He made a speech before the Atlantic Council in which he said some nations have looked the other way in the face of threats from Russia. Russia brazenly and implausibly denies its actions, and we have failed to impose sufficient costs. Now, what was extraordinary was that Sarah Sanders, the White House spokesperson, when asked a question by a reporter of what is their response, the White House's response to General McMaster's remarks, critical of the passivity of the Trump administration, Sanders turned around and said that, no, that's not what McMaster said. He said that nobody's been tougher on the Russians than Donald Trump, which is a complete lie. I mean, it seems like the White House has now become like some third world farce, like Saddam Hussein's Baghdad Bob's extraordinary press conferences. So I guess that's a separate issue, but I was astounded by that. Perhaps I'm naive, but let's talk about McMaster's remarks. How did they strike you?
Well, I think General McMaster was correct, is that we have not imposed sufficient penalties on Russia for what was a hugely egregious action by the Russians, their attempt to affect the 2016 presidential election. And my concern is that since we have not imposed real cost on the Kremlin sees no reason why it should not try it again in the 2018 elections or the 2020 elections. Now, I guess on the question of has the Trump administration been tough on Russia, it's kind of an interesting appearance. I think you have actually seen steps over the last year and a half, such as the expulsion of Russian diplomats, such as the decision to provide lethal military assistance to Ukraine, something the Obama administration would not do, that in a way are tougher. I mean, there's been sort of a continuation of and a toughening of the Obama policy towards Russia, at least the Obama policy of the last couple of years of its term. But I think these are policies that are carried out by the administration that I'm not sure the president himself believes in. I mean, certainly when the president talks about Russia or he talks about Vladimir Putin, he doesn't criticize Putin. He keeps talking about wanting a better relationship with Russia, which I would like to see, but it's very difficult to see how you get to a better relationship with Russia if Russia is not prepared to correct some of its misbehavior.
Well, there are a couple of fronts, though, where Donald Trump's behavior borders on raising suspicions of, I guess treason is a pretty harsh word, but raises the question of who is our president? Who is he working for? Because, for example, the 2,000 U.S. soldiers that are in Syria now occupy the oil fields that are valuable to Assad. They sit astride what would be a land corridor between Tehran and Damascus, and Trump wants to pull them out. And the military is saying, no, you can't do that. We haven't finished off the Islamic State, and they'll just come back. And then on top of that, the Kurds will be slaughtered by the Turks, Assad, the Iranians, and the Russians. And frankly, you'll be handing over Syria to Russia. So that's one issue that raises real questions in my mind. And the other one is when his own National Security Council told him not to congratulate Putin, he went ahead and congratulated him. And then we learned from the Russians that Trump invited Putin to the White House at the time when the 26 nations were ostracizing him for the nerve agent attack on British soil.
Now, I think if you are an American analyst sitting in Moscow right now, trying to figure out U.S. policy is probably pretty difficult because the president keeps sending very different signals which differ radically from the message that his administration tries to communicate. I mean, on a summit idea, quite frankly, a summit between Presidents Trump and Putin could be useful if there are two big ifs. If the summit is well prepared and President Trump is well prepared, and if President Trump is prepared to confront Putin on where Russia has carried out transgressions, its aggression against Ukraine, its interference in the U.S. election, the poisoning of the former Russian spy in Britain. And I don't think the president is prepared to do those sorts of things. That's where, a summit, then can be a little bit dangerous, because you got to know that Vladimir Putin would come to that meeting very well prepared.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and a Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. So today at the United Nations Security Council, Russia called a meeting where its ambassador spoke for about an hour, with extremely skillful propaganda, which, frankly, the Russians are really good at that. And it made it all seem like the poisoning of the Russian double agent in the English country town of Salisbury was all done by the Brits. Why the Brits would use a Russian nerve agent against these Russians, father and daughter, along with British first responders, is pretty mind-boggling. But that's basically the case that Vasily Nebenzia put forth to the UN today. He asserted with a high degree of probability the intelligence services of other countries are behind the March 4th poisoning of the former double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter, quoting the Russian ambassador to the Security Council. This is a coordinated, very well-planned campaign aiming to undermine Russia's role, not only in finding a solution in Syria, but anywhere else. So what's going on here? I mean, this is clearly designed to muddy the waters ahead of next week's release of the report by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the watchdog group based in The Hague, that rejected Moscow's bid to join in the investigation. Clearly, the Russians are worried about that. And but do you think that anybody's, I mean, apart from the few loony leftists who send letters to me, I can't see anybody's going to believe this.
It was a Russian-produced nerve agent. The Russian security services, the successors to the KGB, they take a very dim view of traitors, and in their mind, Skripal was a traitor. And you have a history of mysterious deaths of Russian emigres, Russians who've gone to Britain. The Litvinenko poisoning with polonium back 10, 12 years ago. So I think the clearest evidence points to a Russian hand in this. What you see Moscow doing, though, is throwing out all kinds of theories. There was one theory advanced by their ambassador at the United Nations today about Britain being responsible. But over the last 2 weeks, they've said, well, this nerve agent could have been produced in the United States. It could have been produced in Sweden. It could have been produced in the Czech Republic. And this has become, I think, really the typical Russian response to these kinds of charges, is not to present a credible alternative, but to throw out lots of ideas in the hopes of creating so much smoke and mirrors that people just begin to doubt all versions, very much like we saw in the aftermath of the shoot-down by Russian-supported proxy forces in Ukraine of the Malaysian airliner back in 2014.
Well, there's certainly a deja vu quality to that. I was about to bring that up, as a matter of fact. But in general, what is the way out of this situation? My sense is that, and I've heard this from a number of Russians, that Putin, ironically, is a victim of his own success with the Russian people. They think he's a genius and that he pulled off the greatest piece of intelligence tradecraft in history by installing Donald Trump in the White House. Therefore, the average Russian feels they don't have anything to worry about the Americans anymore. They don't feel threatened by them because we own their president. So is that what's going on here, that they picked on the Brits because they were just low-hanging fruit, because Putin needed to do something to rile up his people to get him to vote for him in this bogus election that he just took place?
Well, I partially agree and partially disagree. I mean, it seems to me that one of the problems we have in dealing with Russia right now is Russia believes that it can violate the rules. It can use military force to take territory from Ukraine with its seizure of Crimea and its involvement in Donbass, with the idea of going, it can assassinate Russians on the territory of sovereign nations. and it doesn't believe that there are serious consequences to these actions. And I would very much like to see us get back to a better relationship with Russia, but it seems to me that the path to getting there is beginning to impose costs on the Russians for this kind of behavior, and then the Russians may well adjust and begin to come back into and play by the rules. And then discussions may be a lot more productive in trying to get out of this low point we are. But, you know, there's, I think, a fairly strong signal that in the West there's a wide view that Russia has basically gone beyond the pale. The striking thing to me about the expulsion of the Russian diplomats that took place early last week was you had almost 30 countries. You've never seen that kind of action, but 30 countries expelling Russian diplomats based on evidence which we have not seen publicly, but evidence that Britain has shared with their European partners in other countries. And I think that probably surprised the Russians. Now, the Russians responded as they typically do with expulsions, is they expelled diplomats in return. But my guess is in the Kremlin, it was a bit of a shock to see that much of Europe and other countries line up with Britain in saying this is not acceptable behavior. The question is, can we now find a way to press Moscow to change its behavior?
Well, do you think that these sanctions that are supposed to be announced next Tuesday against Russia, supposedly against some oligarchs, are they going to have any teeth?
We'll have to see. I mean, the expulsions were a very useful political symbol, but we also, I mean, I'm sure that in the U.S. government, when they did those expulsions, they fully understood that the Russians would retaliate with counter-expulsions. So that's a useful signal. But what the Kremlin fears more are steps that begin to get at people close to the Kremlin personally, and also steps that can have an impact on the Russian economy. And if there are now serious economic sanctions, asset seizures, for example, in addition to visa bans, that begin targeting people close to the Kremlin, I'm not sure you have a group there that can overrule Putin, but they're going to have a concern that the Kremlin will pay some attention to. And that would be the kind of message that it would be difficult for the Kremlin to respond to, because there simply is no analog in terms of Americans who want to bring a lot of money into Russia.
Well, there is a lot of Europeans that that are hooked on Gazprom, too. I don't know whether there's anything that can be done there, or naming and shaming all the money that Putin's had abroad.
But it's a fair point. But I think we also have to understand, it's easier for Americans to talk about economic sanctions on Russia than for Europe, because prior to 2014, the economic relationship, the trade between Europe and Russia, was about 10 times the trade between the United States and Russia. So economic sanctions have an impact on Europe more so than on the United States. But if you look over the last 4 years, actually the European Union has hung in there with some fairly tight sanctions. And I think even in the case of the gas, while they are dependent on, or that they get a large portion of their natural gas from Russia, I believe over the last 8 or 9 years you've seen also a number of European companies build facilities to receive liquefied natural gas so that if they ever got into a gas crisis with Russia, they have an alternative. And that's got to make Gazprom a little bit nervous.
But just in closing, it would seem, though, that Russia's investment in its economy and its future is entirely at odds with global warming. In other words, their whole economic plan for the future is to sell more oil and sell more gas and just about nothing else.
I would argue that that's not a winning strategy for Russia. First of all, some of the sanctions that are being applied will deny Western technology and Western capital for future gas and oil field developments in Russia. So as they deplete existing fields, it's going to be harder and more costly for them to bring new fields online. But also, as long as Russia continues to be so dependent on energy exports, you know, it's not developing an economy that makes things. I mean, other than weapons, Russia doesn't build things that the world wants to buy. And I think as long as they continue to have an economy whose export structure is 70% oil, gas, gold, and timber, you know, it's going to be an economy that's going to have a hard time competing in the 21st century. And Mr. Putin doesn't seem to get that. And I think that's likely to lead to a weakening of the Russian state over the next 10 or 15, 20 years.
Well, Stephen Pfeiffer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a former news director of a TV station that the Sinclair Group took over and forced the local news anchors to mouth must-run pro-Trump propaganda.